we get things underway by getting on the telephone and welcoming back to the program from the Boston Globe, Bob Ryan. Bob, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you with us. And let's start with the World Cup. You made a bold statement recently, Bob, and said, if you're not a fan of the World Cup, then you are not a true sports fan.
Yeah, that didn't go over real well with some people. But, you know, it's a little bit of a hyperbole. But the point I was trying to make is simply that Americans are far too parochial as a rule, that there's a larger world out there, that there's sports beyond baseball, basketball, football, and hockey, and that not to be able to appreciate the scope and spectacle of an event that is more important to more people in the world than anything else on this planet, which includes the Olympics. People here don't quite grasp this, but this is a bigger event than the Olympics and to the rest of the world. And so I just think that I was kind of calling people out a little bit. You know, ultimately, these kind of pronouncements are a bit hyperbolic, I will admit it.
But it was a great tournament. Croatia was such a wonderful story. England making a run for the first time in decades, and then France ultimately winning their second straight. There were no shortage of wonderful stories around the World Cup.
Remember, it all started the early great story was Iceland. The very idea of their participation, a country of 330,000 people, that made it legitimately fair and square, affirmative action, host country. They got in there fair and square, and the likes of Italy, the Netherlands, and the United States of America were forced to watch Iceland play. That was their first great early story. And then when they tied Argentina, or as the announcer properly said, they beat Argentina 1-1, that was a wonderful story, but they couldn't follow through with a victory and they went home. Still, that was the first real good one. Then we had so many others that unfolded, and individual ups and downs and the plight of Messi in Argentina, and on and on and on it went. And then finally we got down to a country that of 4 million people that when the last time that France won the cup was part of Yugoslavia, was not its own separate country, Croatia. And they're getting to play against the mighty France was a great story. There's so many, as you say, and individual rises and falls. We all learned about Harry Kane, and we learned about the young English team that will be back and with a vengeance in 2022. And I couldn't – every day I'm having withdrawal, Rich. I mean, I'm serious. I got used to it. Every day it's who's playing at 10, who's playing at 2, and I would build my day around it, and I'm not kidding. I built my day around, many a day around, who was playing and what time.
Well, there are already questions abounding about what will happen in 4 years because much of the infrastructure isn't even begun to be constructed for the next round of World Cup.
Well, the next one is a disgrace. The problem that it exacerbates is that we know that FIFA is corrupt. And it is corrupt, as is the IOC. And so a lot of people can't get into the event because they say, well, its governing body is corrupt to start with. And I can understand if you just can't get beyond that. I can go right to the competition. But the idea that Qatar will have this, a country of a desert country that has no soccer background, that will be forcing people that will be playing it in the winter now in November and December because the searing heat would prevent it from possibly being played. The fact that it's a country, Islamic country, that will not welcome alcohol, good luck to that. Well, I know they're going to make allowances to a degree, but it will not be enough to satisfy the thirsty Europeans who are coming in, I can assure you. And everything's wrong with it. They have no business being awarded it. It was a bribery thing, clearly. I mean, there's no other way to even imagine it. And I don't know how this one's going to go over. I will say that it appears that Russia pulled it off. Putin, when he wants to do something, can marshal the forces and do it. And he did it. And apparently it was a very successful one in many ways, as well as artistically. But the next one could be an utter disaster. We can only hope that somehow, some way, before it happens, they will pull it from Qatar and give it to somebody that can properly run it.
We saw Putin's power on display today, but I digress. Let's talk about American football here, Bob. And as someone who has been following the game for decades, what's the future of professional football in this country with more bad news time and time again about not just concussions, but even those head injuries that don't lead to concussions and their cumulative effect?
We are a nation in denial. We're a nation of enablers. I don't see how any rational person who is literate, that has read or heard anything on this topic over the last 3 or 4 years, can look at football the same way, with the same degree of enthusiasm and passion. And I include myself as an enabler. I'm going to watch. I'm not going to upset myself that we have a great team here. We've got the great stuff. But the fact is that this is a game that maims people. And we always knew that it maimed you from the neck down. Now we know that it can impair your life from the neck up at a far too early age. It doesn't mean everyone is going to be susceptible to this or subjected, but it does mean that a sad and disproportionate number of its participants are facing dismal lives somewhere down the road because they have chosen to participate in this game. And what's going to change it? All this, it can never be made safe. It can be made marginally safer. Yes, it can never be made safe. America has chosen as its favorite sport a sport that maims people. That's the reality. We all have to live with it.
We're talking with Bob Ryan here on Downtown. We're at the All-Star break, Bob, and the Red Sox with a remarkable run here, first place by 4.5 games in the East. Do you see attendance in baseball waning?
It is. Well, I mean, I know it is. I know that they're down. They're 6%. It's not a horrendous drop, but it's a concerning drop. Some of it is attributable to just terrible teams. Obviously, the two Florida teams, though, are another matter because what's happening in Miami is frightening. They're averaging, they've had 20 crowds under 10,000 already this year, they're going to have the lowest attendance baseball has had in a major league city since the 94. Since the lame duck expos, 04, I think it was. So the lame duck expos, when you can understand why people didn't come out there. Yeah, it's worrisome. And the pace of game and the lack of action, is that the reason necessarily? You know, everybody's talking about, you know, too many balls are not in play. There are too many strikeouts. For 2 months in a row, we had more strikeouts than hits for the first time in the history of baseball. And yet, I don't get that feel, and of course we have Red Sox exception to that, but I don't think that's necessarily it. I don't really know what it is exactly. I think it's more to do perhaps with the competition factor. But baseball has gotten itself in a situation with haves and have-nots. Clear, way too many have-nots. I think it's had an effect. There's no question.
You tweeted the other day about the Boudreaux shift. Lou Boudreaux employed when he was a player manager, I think, with the Cleveland Indians. This is not a new thing, but the extent to which the shift is being used in baseball today, is that bad for the game?
You know, I think it is. I think it's. But what are you going to do? All games have inherent flaws some way, somehow. And basketball, the whimsical nature of refereeing, football to a certain extent has that same problem. They all have some kind of internal flaw. Baseball, they have to worry about that. I think they're very definitely. I'm sorry. What was the? I lost track of my hair.
If the shift in and of itself is bad for the game.
One thing I'd like to find out, and I pose this rhetorical question, and perhaps some of your astute listeners know the answer to this. We know that the shift came into vogue it came into being on July 14th, 1946, the second game of a doubleheader. After Ted had a monstrous first game, Boudreaux said, enough, I had enough of this, and he went into the Boudreaux shift. How long did it last that people went into that extreme shift? I don't even know how long it lasted or how many other people adopted it. I just know that they did shift it. Cleveland did for a number of years. Did anybody else? I don't know what happened. All I know is this. By the time Ted retired in 1960, and I think long before that, it was gone. And after he went, there was no more shifting of any sort, except a little bit outfield, obviously playing one way or the other. There might be shading. A shortstop might shade towards second for a left-hand pull hitter. Very seldom would you see three people on the right side of the infield. Sometimes you would, but you'd never see a shift such as we see now with a second baseman way out in right field and short right field and the shortstop playing decidedly on the right side of second base, and the third baseman playing shortstop, et cetera, which as we see now. It's taking hits away. It's definitely hurting left-hand hitters. Poppy opined the other day that it cost him 500 hits. I think that is an exaggeration, but it might have cost him 100, and that's for sure.
This is the anniversary. This day in 1941, Joe DiMaggio extended his hitting streak to 56 games. Where does that rank in your mind in the list of individual accomplishments in baseball
yeah,
history?
Yeah, you know, in 50, on the next night, the 17th, he was robbed twice of potential hits by Ken Keltner. He smacked the ball, but it ended. Then, of course, he went off and went on another 16-game hitting streak after that. Well, it's a singular achievement. I think the pressure, I don't think it would have been possible today, even for a Joe DiMaggio, because the attendant pressure. Now, I know the country was aware of it as much as it could be aware of it in 1941, but you didn't have the media scrutiny and the media capability of micromanaging every day coverage the way you do now. But it's amazing, 56. But let's put it in context, too. 1941, he hit .408 over those 56 games. Now, you know what Ted hit for the whole season. So that just tells you how amazing. And then DiMaggio did beat out Ted for the MVP that year, and which is an interesting story. And the Red Sox, the Yankees did win the pennant and the World Series. But, it's fantastic. 56 games. Then, I mean, let's face it, the next closest is 44 in the major league level, right? And so... That tells you what an incredible thing it was.
Away from sports, before we let you go, I saw that SpongeBob SquarePants will be closing on Broadway in September, and you've said that was one of the most enjoyable theatrical experiences you've had.
It was the biggest single surprise, pleasant, in this case, afternoon matinee back in December of the theater I have ever had in my life. Now, we went because we have a grandson who was a huge SpongeBob fan, and the minute we heard that there was going to be a play, we said, "Well, we got to take him." That's fine. And then, but I had no personal expectation of enjoying it. I know nothing about SpongeBob, and I was skeptical. Then the reviews came out, and the reviews were spectacular. And I said, "Oh, well, maybe there's going to be something here anyway." But I still wasn't sure I was going to go in and really fall in love with it. For the minute they struck up the music, which precedes the actual beginning of the play, I was hooked. And it was so clever, so creative, and the performers were so good at what they did. And I thought that, frankly, this was going to have legs and that it would have a chance to be the next second coming of The Lion King. Well, it shows you I better stick to sports writing because it didn't even last a year, and it's closing after 239 performances, I think it's going to be, something like that, and The Lion King goes on and on. So I was wrong about that. But I'm telling you, people who are SpongeBob parents and had an opportunity blew it because they would have loved it. I'm telling you, this play is really enjoyable. Well, I don't know that'll ever be revived, but this production deserves credit for putting on a wonderful night and afternoon at the theater.
I see. They are working on a national tour, though, and I suspect this will be one of those shows that will be produced endlessly by high school and college theater programs forever.
The problem that will be there is I wonder how dependent it is on not just good, but phenomenally good talent to pull it off. Ethan Slater, who played SpongeBob, it's just hard to, I can't exaggerate or even convey how good he was. And so many of the others were equally good. They're going to have a problem finding enough people in America who are going to pull this off. That's the problem.
Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe, always a pleasure, Bob. Thanks for making time for us this afternoon.
You're entirely welcome. Bye-bye.